Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here. We're going to start on page 286 of the framework book, and try to go from around 650 up to 900 AD. It's a lofty goal, a lot of years, but I think we can cover it. We'll see how it goes. But beginning on page 286, we just introduced last week the concept of Muhammad having come. And so go back to page 285, you can see the years of Muhammad's life, 570 to 632. It was actually in 610. You know, right here I've got 650 here, but it's in 610 he began to have revelations or visions. And by 627, Mecca responded with a failed attack on Medina. 629, Muhammad attacked the Byzantine Empire. He failed, but it was beginning to attack the Byzantine Empire. 630, Muhammad defeated Mecca and entered the city. 631, Muhammad ruled most of the Arabian Peninsula. So if you look at the map that you see right there, that map at 600 AD, that was the Christian world, basically. North Africa was Christian. Go from Jerusalem, was obviously Christian, going up into Syria, Turkey, over into Rome and through Greece. That was Christian. Paul had done work himself over in Spain. That had a Christian influence. But by the time Muhammad died in 632, the Arabian Peninsula that had a Christian influence there had been overrun by Muhammad and his followers. And then you're going to have an expansion. That's what we've got here. 622 to 750. So from about the time of Muhammad's death to 750 AD, these are the waves. Now, the Titanic Faith book breaks this down into more detail, gives you more of a history, but this is just kind of an overview of what's taking place in what is, at that time, the Christian world. So just keep in mind, this entire Christian world right here is going to be overrun by Islam. If we didn't have Europe and North America, for example, you know, the Western world, Christianity at that time would be, well, you know, it's going different directions, but it's going to be conquered by Islam or Muslim faith at this time. Well, between 622 and 632, on Muhammad takes the Arabian Peninsula, 632 to 661, they take part of North Africa, the Iranian Empire or the old Babylonian Empire extending up into Baghdad. Jerusalem is taken. Antioch, Alexandria were taken from the Christians. The building of the Dome of the Rock or the Temple Mount takes place at that time. So before 700 AD, the Dome of the Rock had been built on the location it is at right now. It's the same building, the same graffiti or the Arabic script, including what's inside, rejecting the Trinity, rejecting the Son of God. All quotes taken out of the Quran. Then between 661 and 750, Muslims take the rest of North Africa. Now watch this. They cross the Strait of Gibraltar, which is going from North Africa up into Spain. And they take Spain in 711. And you can see it's drawn. I've got it colored in there. By 711, they've gone from Arabia, the Arabian Peninsula, gone all the way up and have crossed into Europe and are heading north. They are heading north. There's nothing. They're not just saying, I don't know what we're doing here. No, they are going to keep right on going. And again, some people will consider it a big deal. Some people, modern writers, try to make it minimal. The Muslims are going to just discount it. We'll talk about it here. But the Battle of Tours is going to stop their momentum north. Otherwise, there would be no Europe that we knew in the 1900s. So what's happening to Europe today was stopped at this time in history. Otherwise, it would have already happened. And you wonder how much of the hand of God is in that. You know, if obviously God knows history, but you wonder how miraculous it was to have it held back, and what's taking place today in history. The Muslim Empire extended from the coast of the Atlantic Ocean in North Africa to the borders of modern Pakistan. That's how far it expanded, and that's by 750. So we're going to go from 650, or say Muhammad died in 632. In a matter of 120 years, they're going to cover that much territory. That's craziness. I mean, as far as that's Alexander the Great type expansion, that's a historical momentum. And again, a lot of people are converting, but they're not converting by faith. They're converting by military force. Okay, that's taking place. We'll talk more about that here on the next page. But meanwhile, in the Christian world, 664, the Synod of Whitby takes place. At this Synod of Whitby, they determined that the English church would come under the authority of Rome. The Celtic Christian in Britain, Iona, and Ireland had developed its own style of Christianity that included the observance of Easter in accordance with the apostolic ideal from, you know, John and Polycarp. We talked about that before. But at this time, they've got to convert over to their form, the Roman Catholic form of Christianity. Again, like I said before, several weeks ago, up in the area of Britain, Ireland, they had a Christianity, but it was a very early form of Christianity coming out of Asia Minor, apparently. Now it's been, in a sense, conquered by the Roman Church. In 680, there's a Council of Constantinople, the Third Council of Constantinople, and that's where they determined the two wills of Christ. I want to mention a guy named Bede. He's Celtic. By 731, he completed a very important work called the Ecclesiastical History of the English Nation. So there's a lot of things going on in his writing in 731, and it's great work to go back and look and see what he records, writing in English, very early form of English. He records what's been taking place there as far as church history. And Bede, no scripture, has some scriptural references. That's taking place there as Rome is expanding north with its Catholic faith. Now, 732, I referred to this earlier, that's the Battle of Tours. The Muslims had crossed into France by 720. And in 732, Charles Martel, we'll talk about him again later in a line of great leaders, including Charlemagne. But Charles Martel stopped the Muslim invaders threatening Europe. Islam's Western expansion was stopped at that point in 732. And it's a historical fact, but of course we don't know and people argue about it today. But if 732, if the Battle of Tours had gone the other way, if there was no Charles Martel, Islam would have just kept right on coming. There was nothing to stop them going into Europe. Charles Martel rallied the troops, made a stand, and what's interesting is in English history or Western history, it's a big deal. But in Muslim history, they mention the battle just in passing. When you read their history, they just mention it in passing, and it's the battle. It's called something about the martyrs. You know, the battle of the martyrs or where the martyrs fell, and then they just forget about it. But it really was a turning point in history because at that point, that's where the breaking point stopped. Now, we'll talk more about this in a little bit as we continue, because Islam is going to continue to attack. Again, like I say, in the Titanic Faith book, I put more detail in it. But they're going to continue to attack from North Africa, continue to attack Italy. They're going to attack Rome. The Pope is going to have to build a wall around the Vatican to protect himself from the Muslims. He's going to pay the Muslims to go away. Otherwise, Rome would have been overrun by Islam. The Crusades are coming. Crusades are very easy to make fun of. I mean, in our teaching here, they're coming up historically. They're very easy to make fun of and mock the Crusades. But when you look at it, and I do more detail again in Titanic Faith, the Crusades they had to do something. The church was being attacked by Islam. Constantinople, the head of the Roman Empire, or the Byzantine Empire, is constantly under attack. And they're doing the best they can. And they've got to call for help, backup from Europe to come in and just protect them. They need some kind of military defense, otherwise the church is going to be overrun. So there's and Christianity is being destroyed in Jerusalem and in the Middle East as far as churches, Christians, and holy sites. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre, Jesus' tomb that they just excavated recently, did some work in there. The Muslims destroyed all of Constantine's work as far as the buildings and in the Byzantine Empire. They're destroying the holy sites. They'd have to because it's a false religion, and they're dominating. And so if the Crusades hadn't come in and fought, it would have been they're trying to erase Christianity from history. Anyway, we'll talk more about that later. Meanwhile, back in the church, in the year 726, interesting concept here. Some of this stuff is so strange, at least to me. But yeah, the iconoclastic controversy. And iconoclast is one who destroys sacred religious images. It comes from two Greek words, Ikon, which means image or likeness, and clastos, which means breaker. The iconoclastic controversy. In other words, there's going to be two views. Well, we'll talk about it. Basically, two views on images. Some people think the image can be a doorway or a connection to the unseen. So say you've got an image of Jesus. It's something that you can't see Jesus, you can't worship Jesus, but you've got this image, this statue, this picture, this carving. You could worship the image, and that'd be like projecting worship to Jesus. It makes you think of the Ten Commandments. Make no images. And so it's like, don't go there. You cannot capture the eternal God in an image. If you reduce it to an image, a picture, you're going to limit your impression of what he is, or who he is. Again, that's me summarizing it. But here's going to come two groups of people. Some are going to use it very religiously, or part of the religious system is going to be images. Others are going to say, we can't do this, and they're going to start destroying them. And they're going to go around, well, here we go. The destroying of Christian art and images by Christians trying to prevent idol worship occurred in the East. So basically, you've got people from the Western Christianity, say Latin Christianity, moving into the East and destroying the Easterns or worship. Well, in the East, they were destroying it. There was no conflict with images in the West. They accepted the images, they accepted the statues, the artwork, no problem. But in the East, there's a controversy. Arts, and I just write a few notes here. Arts have always been viewed with different opinions by Christians. Some opinions, they say there should only be Christian art. Some say there should be no art at all. Some, you should avoid all visual representation. And I need to study it more, but I've always been intrigued because as we live our Christian life out, it affects our art. And it leaves behind an impression of what we thought. And it's fun to go through history, especially listen to someone that knows what they're talking about as far as art and Christianity, and see them portray different pictures, famous pictures you're familiar with or you've seen. And the artist is not just randomly painting, like I probably would, just trying to paint a picture that looks like what I see. They're capturing theology or concepts in their work, and to take and overlay the theology of the day with the artwork that tries to represent it is a very interesting study. And again, I haven't done much of it. I've read about it. And for example, here's a little statement, an example, a painting of Mary. One would be to capture the idea of flesh being given God's splendor. Mary, the flesh, was crowned in God's promised redemption, sitting under a gilded arches, being approached by a shining winged creature. So in that case, you've got a human kind of being surrounded with glory as God approached humanity through Mary with the birth of Christ. Now again, this is more of a Catholic representation honoring Mary, that it was through Mary that God came to humanity. Or another way of presenting it would be to show the harsh human conditions of the early Christianity. One would paint Mary as an ordinary, in an ordinary surroundings. So instead, you maybe would have Mary be the one that's got the glittering goldish look, of deity, but she would be clothed in very common clothes among very common surroundings. So you've got God kind of within Mary. And again, the emphasis here is on Mary because the Catholic Church drifted towards that. So again, they're trying to capture either a very humble-looking Mary with godliness all around her, she's the vessel, or again, the other way around, where she's got the God inside of her and is, in a very humble situation. Anyway, all these things were portrayed through the years of Christianity. And at this point right here, people would begin worshiping, or they had been trying to make contact with God or worship God through images, through idols, through, again, not idols. Some would call them idols. I would call them idols. But more like statues or paintings or whatever it was. So what they're doing in the East is they're putting an end to it. They're not accepting image worship, and it's going to become a problem. 680, a new controversy broke out concerning the use of icons or images in 680 AD. It was the debate over what was sacred or holy and deserved worship. So now you're worshiping images, or you're using these images. Again, no one's going to go into idol worship in Christianity, but they are going to worship an image or see this image as a form of communication with God, or to worship God, to touch the image, to see the image, to look at the image, is to be close to God. Again, it's not something I necessarily deal with in my own faith or my religion, but the church was at this time. But now the question is going to be, which images? It's not just any image. If you're going to have a certain doorway to heaven or an image that represents God that you can worship God through, it's got to be a special image. We're going to be able to put it in a box somewhere and bring it out certain times and put it away. It just can't be, you know, somebody's cross necklace, everybody's cross necklace. It's got to be the cross necklace that we keep in the box. Or, you know, how do you know if it's holy or not? So now we got to determine which one, just like we had to determine which books or letters are going to be accepted as Scripture, we've now got to filter through all of the artwork and decide which is the special holy artwork. Again, we're kind of off target here. You see what I'm saying? It's like, kind of like we're off base. It's not, I'm not just making this up. And this was the issue of the day. It's almost like they're running out of things to talk about. So the clergy were set apart and so holy. Also church buildings, martyrs, heroes of the faith, such as hermits and monks, were set apart as holy. Martyrs were set apart and considered saints. The holiness of saints was evaluated by miracles that took place at their tomb, with their relics, or with an image. So you could have, someone could perform, like now, you know, talk about sainthood in the Catholic Church. I don't know much about it because it's not my part of my faith. But there's a certain levels of requirements. You have to perform a miracle or do certain things, be holy, sanctified, and then be recognized by the Pope and would be received sainthood. But also, if at the tomb, wherever the saint is buried, because they were a doorway to God while they were living, now while they're dead, you can still maybe use them as an avenue, as an advocate before God. Or if a miracle takes place, because like the relic sometimes would be brought out, if it be a lump of hair or the bones of one of the ancient martyrs, and a miracle takes place because of that bone, now we've got a relic that's got some power to it. Now, by the time, this is something you get into the Reformation, there's a lot of writing going on about this. Guys like Martin Luther were just really ridiculing this whole practice because there were so many relics in the 1500s. People had, the Crusades had taken place, they brought stuff back, sometimes supposedly had brought stuff back and really didn't, as far as things that were the official. I mean, they had the fingers of John the Baptist, they had all kinds of stuff that they had, ridiculous stuff. Someone once said they had more pieces of the cross than the cross, there's more relic or portions of the cross left than that could make many crosses. There's so much wood left, but they're making stuff up, apparently. So that's 680. By the 700s, every city had at least one famous saint, meaning to identify your church, your religion, to have your advocate, the churches were identified by a particular saint, probably someone that ministered there, died there, and the saints are a huge list, not just John the Baptist or the Apostle Paul or someone that we maybe know from early church history, but are numerous and are branching out. And every city would have a select saint that would represent, it's almost like a team mascot. And it became the protector of the city. Because again, we don't understand this. I don't understand this as a Protestant, but I've had Catholics explain it to me. It's like, you know, you can pray to God. Here's how it's been explained to me. And again, it needs to be interpreted and maybe re-explained by a Catholic. But I can pray to God, but I'm way down here. And if you could get someone's attention, maybe like, you know, a relative. I mean, they're already there. And so, you know, it's like, hey, you know, or maybe Mary or somebody that's got some extra time. And God's busy. I mean, look at the world today. I mean, it's chaos. I mean, so many things for God to worry about that you're praying. It's like you're going to get shoved in the back. But if you could maybe find someone that, you know someone's uncle who's close that you could maybe get in, and maybe the uncle knows God directly, he's right there, maybe he's, you know, he maybe, you know, slip in a sticky note or something, say, could you take care of, and that was the logic. And so your city had a local saint, and you honored that saint because that saint was already there. Obviously they were there because look what they did. They did this great thing. They were committed to God. They did these miracles. But they've passed away. We honor them here. And the reason we honor them is so that we can have favor. It's not, we don't believe that the saint's going to do something for us, but we do believe that the saint will approach God for us. And God then will do something on our behalf. It makes complete sense. And so you would pray to the saint, or you'd appeal to the saint, not because you think the saint is God, but the saint is already in heaven. And so with that kind of logic, you would, and again, you want your own saint. Because if everybody's got the same Saint Paul, you're all going to Saint Paul. The same problem happens. Saint Paul is trying to take care of all these cities and hear everybody's prayers. It's like, you've got to find that unique saint that's got extra time. The unknown superstar, the next up-and-coming mega saint that's just getting started. And you find that, boom, you're going to see things happen in your city. Now, I don't advocate this, but it does make complete sense if you start going down that track. So, in the 700s, every city had at least one famous saint that was worshipped and became the protector of the city. Not that they're actually doing the protecting, but they've got access to resources that we don't have access here on earth. The government and church encouraged this. Can you see we're heading to this time period called the Dark Ages? Okay. Icons became multiple. They multiply because we're using these things as doorways. Saint Demetrius of Thessalonica, for example, or the miraculous Christ icon at Edessa, Syria, the miracle-working icon of Mary in Constantinople. Most Christians placed faith in the icon and made no spiritual connections to its meaning, thus it became idolatry. In other words, you go out and you look at a beautiful sunrise and you think of your great God, the great creator, and how big he must be, and it's like it causes you to reflect, and you call that morning devotions. You call that being with nature. You go out and you pray outside. You're not worshiping. You're being jarred into thinking. Same way I could see if there's been pictures that have been effective to me, like paintings. You look at some, and you look at it, it's like we've got a picture in our hallway of Jesus praying. He's just a picture of Jesus praying. And it just, I don't worship it. I don't touch it. I don't kiss it. I've never seen tears coming down the painting. But I do see, it's like, I see Jesus. He is still interceding. He's still concerned about the church. He's concerned about us. I'm using this as an example. It's not like an emotional experience I have every time I go down the hallway. I'm using it as an example. It makes me reflect and think about, we do have backup. Jesus is working in our lives. It makes me reflect. Okay, artwork is good. Music can move you to reflect. Art can move you to reflect. And nature can cause you. But once you don't make any spiritual connections to it, and I walked by that painting one day or that picture one day, I thought about Jesus, and it's like, and the very next thing, something happened. The next day, a problem was resolved, and I begin to think, wow, how did this, what happened? I remember I walked by that picture and I stopped and looked at it for a while. I bet there's supernatural power in that picture. So now every morning, no, I'm not making this up. I'm acting it out. Don't get up and leave. But now I walk by and I touch the picture every morning. Or maybe just to keep my, I don't like to leave the picture. So when I'm in the presence of the picture, I'm protected. So this candle will represent me and it will burn in front of the picture all day long while I'm going. And the picture relates, is giving me power. The power is going into the candle. The candle reflects me. It's like, okay, we got this thing going. It's like you're creating your own religion, and you're into idol worship. But you understand, that's what they're saying here on this point right here, is most Christians began to place faith in the icon or the image or the statue or the relic or the saint or the ritual, and made no real spiritual connection. Thus, it became idolatry. If you understand what I'm saying. Okay, 726. That's where the church is at. That's what they're going through. Images. So if you go to church at this time, you're not going to hear Bible teaching as we would call it today. You're going to see more about this system of images and the icons. 726, Emperor Leo III. This is the third Leo. He's an emperor, not a pope. He's an emperor, so he's in Constantinople. He attacked the use of icons. He says it's something we're going to put a stop to. In Eastern Asia Minor, bishops preached against icons. Okay, so now we're in Paul's territory, John's territory. There's people preaching against this icon usage. 726, Leo held off the Muslim attack in Constantinople and then declared his opposition to icons. So understand, 726 in Constantinople, the emperor of the Roman Empire or the Byzantine Empire is fighting for his life, the empire's life, the city's life, because the Muslims are invading. They've already got Syria, they've already got Asia, and they're coming towards him, wanting his city. And he also declares at that time his opposition to icons. A mob murdered a messenger sent to replace the icon of Christ at the imperial gates. The Muslims had destroyed an image in their invasion, an image of Christ, and Pope Leo's like, don't need the image. But a messenger was sent from some churches to replace it because we got to have that image there. That's what's wrong. That messenger was murdered for bringing an icon or an image back to replace it. Whole sections of the empire rebelled against Leo for doing this, for murdering a messenger who was trying to replace an icon that had been destroyed. 730, Leo issued an edict to destroy public icons. Okay, you're going to push the button here. We're going to destroy everything you think is holy. That's an image or a statue or a painting. We're going to destroy it because it's stupid. Yeah, okay, I'm putting words in his mouth. The Bishop of Rome condemned those who destroyed the images. So now you've got Leo over in Constantinople saying, we don't need these images, just destroy them. It's get everybody off track. You're getting distracted. But the Pope now in Rome says, whoa, wait a minute. You can't do that. People honor those. It's part of their religion. They find fulfillment in this. So the Bishop of Rome condemned those who were destroying the images or the iconoclast. The destroyers were called iconoclasts. There it is. The Roman bishop got military support from the Franks. So now the Franks are going to be, in a sense, the Germans are going to be the barbaric tribes coming out of Europe. And the Roman bishop, he's always got to have some kind of military help because he's the one protecting that part of the country. He sends the military, the Franks, European military, over into Asia or to Constantinople to protect the images, the artwork. Leo wanted the cross, the book, and the elements of the Lord's Supper to be holy along with the clergy and the dedicated buildings. Now again, they've already decided that the clergy is holy, a church building is holy, but now Leo wants the cross, the book or the Bible, and the elements of the Lord's Supper to be holy. Leo's son argued the only true icons were sacramental bread and wine because they were the same substance as Christ. Now we got the transubstantiation, and that's where we leave that. We continue. That's not gone away yet. The Western Asia embraces Islam. So Western Asia, that's Ephesus, Colossae, that area there, Paul's churches, John's churches, is going to be now, they're now becoming Muslim. 754, the iconoclast synod of Constantinople. So they're going to get the leaders together. Remember the Council of Nicaea where they got together and they talked about the deity of Christ? Had some major discussions there. Here they're going to have an iconoclast synod, a church meeting, all of church, all of Christendom going to be represented here. During this council, a threefold anathema was pronounced on the advocates of image worship. The Eastern Council said no. The clergy submitted, but the monks who manufactured the pictures denounced the emperor and were subjected to imprisonment, flagellation, mutilation, and death. So the clergy, we're going to talk about, you know, the if you call them pastors or priests or bishops or whatever, they says, okay, we're not going to follow after the images. We're going to stick with whatever, you know, the real spiritual value. The monks who are manufacturing these things said, no, we're going to keep pushing it. Which makes you remind you of the temple of Artemis and Diana in Ephesus, when the goldsmith or the silversmith got mad because people stopped buying the little statues and Paul had a right on his hands. In a sense, it's a similar thing. And in a similar area, very close geographically. This council was later rejected by the church and no longer considered an official church council. Mainly rejected by the Roman Catholic Church because they're the ones who didn't want a big deal about it anyhow. 780, it's going to get worse. 780. Emperor Leo IV says he's going to say no. He's the fourth Leo as far as emperor. He says no to images. He's going to marry Irene. Irene is going to say, yes, I like images. Leo IV, emperor of the East, in the East of Constantinople, kept the laws against icon worship, but his beautiful wife from Athens, Irene, tolerated and even favored icon worship. Leo dies in 780, you know where this is heading. So Leo's out of the picture. His wife, Irene, became co-regent for their 10-year-old son, Constantine. So she's got a little boy. This is going to get bad, so just, you know, hold on. She's got a son who's 10 years old, not old enough to rule. So she's going to be the ruler until he's old enough. But she likes icons as a form of worship. Her husband, who's dead, said no. So that was kind of the rule. But he's dead now. She's the regent. She's ruling for her son until he's of age. Irene raised the persecuted monks to the highest dignitaries. In other words, she brought moving monks up who were the makers of these icons and promoted it. She started filling her cabinet positions with monks who supported icon worship. She removed the iconoclastic imperial guard. So her husband's imperial guard that protected him and the empire were removed and replaced with a guard that agreed with her views. So now the military is on. The leadership is on her side because she gave it to the monks. The military is on her side because she gave it to people that agreed with her. She convened the 8th Church Council. It consisted of 8 sessions from September 24th to October 23rd, 787. So she calls a church council. The Nicene Council nullified the decrees of the Iconoclastic Synod of Constantinople in 754. So this one nullifies the previous church council where they said no, saying it's wrong to worship images. They said no, they got it wrong, and they made a correction. This is why you know church councils are now, at this point, they're just political tools because they're contradicting each other. Acceptable images to worship. Now the list includes these things. These are things you could worship, and they were seen as spiritual, good Christian worship. You could worship the cross. Now, I'm not talking about just having a cross in your house or on a necklace. We're talking about on touching the cross, kissing the cross, you know, asking the cross to help you with problems. Pictures of Christ, pictures of the Virgin Mary, pictures of angels, pictures of saints, the gospel books, relics of saints, all of these are now included as holy. They could be drawn in color or composed of mosaic materials. Either way, you could paint them or put them, make little stones, an image out of stone. That is, the artwork is very important, and now it's going to be part of the worship system. They could be in churches, they could be in a house, they could be on streets or on walls, tables, vessels, or vestments. So you could have a jacket with some kind of cross decoration on it, and that jacket is now holy and has spiritual power. I don't recognize this form of Christianity, do you? Homage could be paid to them by kissing, bowing, burning incense, saying prayers, or burning candles. Now this is going to leave a mark. You haven't completely escaped from this. This leaves a mark on Christianity. I mean, there's still going to be remnants of this, maybe not even that you can't even connect back, but we still have things in our churches that are left over from this time period. The honor paid to the image was a representation of the honor paid to the true reality in heaven. Again, basic concept. You can't see heaven, but you can see this. So touch this, pray to this, and that means you're touching and praying something in heaven. The scripture used for defense were Exodus, Ezekiel, Hebrews 9. You go through and read those verses there. Also alleged testimonies of now dead church fathers. Many of the early church fathers practiced this very thing. This is called fake news, okay? This is alternative truths. Mostly falsified, and alleged miracles performed by images were used to defend the practice. So they're making up stories about how Paul used to do this, and they're using up stories about how this cross did this miracle, and people are being swept into it. Plus, they want to believe it. Large numbers of former iconoclasts repented. People that were the ones that broke the images, the iconoclasts, the breakers of images, repented and prayed together, saying this, "We all have sinned, we all have erred, we all beg forgiveness," and they worshiped the images. That's what was going on in churches. Now, this is the bad part of the story, and I'm sorry. To prevent her son from being able to reign, he's a little boy, he's growing up, now he's a teenager, and Irene realizes that she's going to lose power. She could maintain her power. Irene had her son's eyes plucked out one night while he slept. So he's blind. He can't be an emperor with no eyes. So she's going to reign for 5 more years. and then she's going to be overthrown and taken into exile, and she's going to have to end up working and making money for the rest of her life, living just trying to feed herself in exile for the rest of her life, which is really too good of an ending for her. Anyway, that's that story of Iconoclast and how it affected a royal family of Leo, Irene, and their little boy. 787, the Nicene Council the second Nicene Council. We've talked about this. I refer to it here when we talk about Irene and Leo. This was the council that she ordered. This is a breakdown of that council that she ordered where they began to worship images. It's the 8th church council, and it sanctioned image worship to overcome the previous council that said no. During this council, an image was brought in and kissed by all the delegates. At the conclusion of the council, the delegates said together, "Thus we believe, this is the doctrine of the apostles, anathema upon all who do not adhere to it, who do not salute the statues, who call them idols, and who charge Christianity with idolatry." And so that's the whole council. It's like the Nicene Creed, which is something we like to look at, and the way they talk about the deity of Christ and all the words they put together. This is now what they're arguing about, and this is what their conclusion was, that these idols are valuable. This was Irene's work. So now she's getting idol worship or image worship into the East. The East didn't want anything to do with it. The Western Church, Latin Church, accepted it, tolerated it. But the Eastern Church, what is going to become the Greek Orthodox Church, said no way. Irene forced it on them. The Second Council of Nicaea was far below the first, both morally and doctrinally, obviously. It determined the character of worship in the Eastern Church for all time, and so is still significant. So you understand what I'm saying? In the Greek Orthodox Church, these decisions here still have effect. When you go into the Eastern Orthodox Church, you get over there, it just has kind of like a different flavor to it. It just seems different right away. And you're going to see images, especially old images, things have been handed down, things that are set up kind of like out of place. At least, you know, our modern churches, you know, you have an interior decorator come in and update the paint, update the drapes, and move around some things, make it look more coffee shop-like. Okay, that's outdated. We're going to make it look more, you know, nightclubbish like with some strobe lights. I mean, you're just trying to make your church kind of fit in whatever we're doing in our culture. You go to one of those churches, like, also it's like, it doesn't look like anybody's ever vacuumed in this room. It's like it just keeps building dust upon this whatever. You know what I'm saying? It's just a little different. And that's because of this council right here brought in that idol worship. The Roman church, the Latin church, never came against it. They just kind of kept going with it. But the Eastern church said no to it, and then there was the big breakthrough where they said yes to it and embraced it. And so it is a big deal. Now imagine the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. There's several different denominations from Greek Orthodox and the Roman Latin Church and others that come in there, and there's always tension because of all these things. These issues are still there, and you see things sitting around. It's like, and everything's broken down because they're all in that same building. Imagine having church, running church services in the same building with 8 different denominations every day, and you've got to have terror. I mean, how you walk. I mean, the routines, you can read about it. The routines every day, you can have, there's a fight broke out. The monks were hitting each other because of different issues. And the issue, we can't even begin to understand or imagine. I don't want to belittle it, but it'd be kind of like walking into your child's room and them and their siblings are fighting about something, and you're trying to figure out, what are you fighting about? And it's some little rule or ritual that they've got, and it's like, it's childish. Well, you kind of wonder that sometimes. But then again, people could say that about me too at some level. Okay. The Protestants come on the scene, Protestants disregard this council totally. This is not an official church council. This was a joke. When the Protestants look back on church history, they take serious certain church councils because of decisions that were made. This one, it violates the second commandment. 2, it violates the practice of apostolic Christianity. 3, it's superstitious. 4, the miracle workings done by the Madonnas in the 19th and 20th centuries. It's like they're still, it's like, no, this is not happening. But nonetheless, The positive effect, really, and the positive side of this was they stopped destroying Christian art. Because you wonder about all, just like ISIS is going through and destroying all these archaeological sites now. I mean, a lot of things have been lost. I mean, someone was telling me yesterday about how much the value that has been lost by ISIS, things that we'll never get to explore because they just blew it up. Things that have never been excavated. They're destroying history. Well, at this time, these people, the iconoclasts, were destroying church art. Not that we want to worship it, but it'd be nice to still be able to see it and look in through that artwork and see their culture and see what they were thinking. But anyway, this began to preserve some, so we do have some ancient artwork. Next, here we go. Charlemagne, the crowned emperor. This is a great story. If you turn the page, on page 290, I've got three things written there. I've got, some bullet points. The very top point there, Pepin, the first mayor or leader, he's going to have an illegitimate son. His name's Charles Martel. I've already mentioned him. And after him is going to come Pepin the Great, who's going to end up leading into this whole story of Charlemagne. So please keep that in mind. We're going to go somewhere with this. I've got several things written together here. Charlemagne, the crowned emperor. The divided kingdom considered of an eastern empire in the east and a ruling pope in the west. So basically what we could say today, the Latin church in the west, the Greek church in the east. Or today, in this setting, it's the Byzantine Empire, which has gone to the east, Turkey in that area, dealing with Islamic invasions. But in the west, dealing with barbaric invasions, you've got the Latin church or the Latin kingdom. And so you've got a divided empire. The Pope claims power in 590 and continually increased their claim. Arian Christians called Lombards attacked Rome several times. These are barbarians. Lombards are we call them barbarians, but you've got the Vandals, you've got the Lombards, different groups coming down. These were Arian Christians, which are different than the Catholic Christians or the Latin Christians who are Athanasius. They're of the Nicene Creed. The Pope needed military support and called on the Franks to be his ally. When he had to go against the East, especially during the Iconoclast, we talked about that already, the Pope or the Bishop of Rome brings the Franks in as his military, made an association. This union would shape Christianity into the Middle Ages. Again, think of the barbarians or what are going to become the knights, the Crusades. Those guys are going to come out of Europe, support the Pope. He was the first one here. They're going to bring the Franks in to support him against the East. The Franks had invaded Gaul from their homeland along the Rhine River. So we talk about Franks, you're thinking Germany in that area. And they're going down into Gaul, France, and Spain. This Roman culture now passed through the Franks upon their invasion of Gaul. So Julius Caesar had gone over to Gaul, and he wrote books about that he found success there in his military days. And he brought Roman culture to Gaul. When the Franks came down and fought and crossed the Rhine River and fought Gaul, they absorbed that Roman culture. So when the Franks end up meeting with Rome, they've got a lot of similar cultures. Roman culture is going to bring them together. And here's the first one, Clovis, who ruled the Franks between 466 and 510. Again, notice we're going back in time to pick this up. 466 to 510, he united the territory from the Rhine River down to France, and this helped bring stability to the area. So he's kind of ruling what we'd call Europe, a portion of it. Clovis accepted Christianity in 496, and he's accepting the Roman form of Christianity due to his wife's influence and supernatural aid in battle that he received. And as we said last week, when he becomes a Christian, everybody becomes a Christian. Clovis' sons were weak and just partied in the palace when they came to power, so the kingdom was run by the mayors of the palace. Enters this title called mayors, or we'd call them the visor, the associate, the assistant. And so Clovis was a great leader, united the kingdom, but his sons, whatever, they were spoiled, they never grew up, they just used his power, his inheritance, and partied. And so if anything's going to get done, the mayors who are handling the paperwork are going to take care of it. And Pepin, P-E-P-I-N, at the top of page 290, was the first mayor. So while Clovis' sons are partying, Pepin is running the place. His power was handed to an illegitimate son called Charles Martel. And so we've already mentioned Charles Martel. So Charles Martel, when he comes in, he's the leader of the military. He's the leader of the estate that was left to from Clovis's empire. And Muslims have already talked about it, have come up into Spain and are approaching France. They're moving into the Franks' territory that was Clovis's, run by Pepin. They're all under Roman influence and Roman culture, and now the Muslims are meeting them in France. But Charles Martel is the illegitimate son of the mayor who's actually was ruling for the sons of Clovis, who were just party animals. Charles Martel was the warrior who saved the West for Christianity. He was a Christian, and the Pope knew it. So Pope knows that if it wasn't for Charles Martel, Islam would have moved on up north and then came in at Italy from the north, too. They're getting it from the west or the east, getting it from the south, and they would have been completely surrounded by Islam, and Christianity in Rome would have been dead. So the Pope knows Charles Martel and the Franks have saved him. Martel supported Boniface's work in evangelizing the tribes beyond the Rhine. So the Pope wants to go up and continue to spread Christianity or Roman Catholicism. The Celtic church has already been taken. The Franks and Gaul have been taken. He wants to go across the Rhine into further north territory and spread Roman Catholicism. And he's going to. And Charles Martel is there to help him get evangelism up there. Again, if you want to call it, I'm not there during those days. Are they evangelizing like we would evangelize, or are they spreading their religious system like you would a fundraiser? I mean, again, there's probably a mixture of both going on. Martel's two sons reigned after him. One joined a monastery, leaving Pepin the Great to rule as king. So Charles Martel is going to have two sons. One goes off and joins a monastery. Pepin the Great is going to take the place of his father and begin ruling. Pope Zacharias needed the help against the Arian Lombards. These are invaders, barbarians, in 754 and 756. Pepin donated land in central Italy to the Pope. This was known as the donation of Pepin. It remained the Pope's possession until 1870. So some land that was taken in the war was given to the Pope, so the Pope owns this land. The story continues. About this time, 755, a book appeared called The Donation of Constantine. Now this, again, you don't care about this, but it's fun to know this, which tells the story of Constantine's conversion and how the grateful Constantine made a huge land grant and special rights to the Bishop of Rome. First of all, this book is going to be proven very early and definitely today. It was never written by, it never happened. It was fake news. It was a fake document that the Pope is going to use to say, I've got all these rights. In other words, because Constantine moved east to Constantinople, he is going to, he's going to basically leave behind, say, hey, all this I give to the Pope, the church, this is all yours. You have my position, I'm going east. And it's called the Donation of Constantine, where he donated his power, his position to the Pope. And the Pope is going to say, hey, I'm in charge. I write in the second bullet point, he made a huge land grant and special rights to the Bishop of Rome. It was a forgery, but that was not proven until several centuries later. They think it's true for several generations. They think, wow, this is the way it is. It's going to help establish the Pope. The popes used it and continue to use it even today to defend their claim on land, power, and position because it is given to them by Constantine. In the book, Constantine had leprosy and was baptized by Bishop Sylvester. Sylvester healed him and baptized him, and so Constantine's a Christian. In return, Rome was to have the precedence over all the other churches, and its bishop was to be the supreme bishop. Constantine left the imperial palace, the imperial clothing, and the imperial rank of emperor for the Pope when he left. Constantine then moved east so as not to interfere with the Pope and the gracious gift Constantine left behind. Oh, you thought Constantine moved east to get Rome away from the barbarians or to form a better empire. No, he had leprosy been healed of leprosy and was baptized and was so grateful to be, for being a Christian and for being physically healed that he says, you are more worthy. I'm going to give all of this to you, including my palace, my wardrobe, all my power, all my possessions, all my land. I'll just give it to you and I'll just move east so I don't people don't get us confused. And so that's the Pope. The Pope is now actually Constantine. And so it's going to take a couple centuries. It'll be proved a falsehood. No one believes it today except the Pope still wants to use it sometimes. Constantine then moved east. So that's the donation of Constantine. So now what I'm saying here is the Pope is fighting for power. He's got the Franks. He's got Pepin the Great. All these guys are coming, helping him. The Muslims are being fought off. A lot of things are going on in the Western world. 742 to 814, a man named Charlemagne. He is the son of Pepin the Great. Now remember Clovis, who had the party sons, his mayor Pepin runs the place, who has an illegitimate son called Charles Martel, who stops the invasion of the Muslims. Charles Martel supports the Pope and his work of evangelizing up beyond the Rhine. Martel has a son, two sons. One goes to the monastery. One is going to become Pepin the Great. And then Pepin the Great is going to have a son named Charlemagne. And the next ruler of the West is, and the king of the Franks was Pepin the Great's son, Charlemagne, from 742 and 814. And Charlemagne is indeed a very impressive figure in history, especially in Christianity. Charlemagne began to reign in his father's place in 768. Charlemagne was crowned emperor of the Romans by the Pope in 800 AD. Now, do I have any of this? It seems like I would have more details on this somewhere. But what's going to end up happening, I'm not sure when I'm going to talk about this, but what's going to end up happening is Charlemagne is going to go in 800 AD. He's going to be in Rome at a big Christmas celebration. And he's going to be worshiping. Somehow the Pope, there's conflict between Charlemagne's people and the Pope. And Charlemagne is going to come in and be kneeling at the altar on this big Christmas Day service. And the Pope is going to come up behind him and crown him the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. And so it's like, oh, you're giving your power away. No, he's the Pope who chose the emperor to rule his land. So Charlemagne is going to be over all of the kingdom of Christendom, but the Pope is going to be over Charlemagne. Thus, the church is over the government, which is going to be the way it's going to be run. And that's the way it plays out. Now, forward fast into the days of Napoleon. Remember, you ever seen those pictures of Napoleon or talk about Napoleon? When they came to crown him the emperor, remember what he did? Remember what, does anybody know what Napoleon does when they bring the crown to crown him? The Pope is going to take it off and do the same thing. And before the Pope could grab it, he takes it, crowns himself, has the Pope sit down and takes over. It's kind of like, no, we've just turned the tables. It's kind of a cool move by Napoleon. Okay, anyway. Oh, okay. I'm in the middle of page 290. Charlemagne began to reign in his father's place in 768. In 800, he was crowned by the emperor, by the Roman Pope. Charlemagne continued the policy of protecting the papacy. Charlemagne would influence everything in Western Europe. He was 7 feet tall. He had a large, strong body and a bright face and long white hair. And by the end of his days, though, they said his belly was really big, you know, protruded out. But anyway, he's going to basically be illiterate. He's illiterate. But he's going to advance reading, writing. He's going to advance education. He's going to set up an educational system in Europe. He is really one of the founders of what we would know as Western culture, Western Europe, and establishing this training, the schools, all of these things. Charlemagne is going to do it. I've got more information about Charlemagne here. But he takes place right there. But you notice from the Franks, from Clovis, Pepin, Charles Martel, Pepin the Great, now Charlemagne, and the popes are using these guys the whole time trying to keep their kingdom together. Now, 838, Muslims settle in southern Italy. Not invade, settle in southern Italy, south of Rome, and defeat the Byzantine army that comes over to fight them. So they're living in Italy. Muslims sack Rome and damage the Vatican in 846. So they've gone all the way around, tried to get up into Europe, and now they are attacking the Vatican. This is when there's going to be, part of the wall is going to be built. 869, Constantinople Council IV. It's the Ninth Church Council. It brought about the final schism between the East and the West. So again, you got the Greek Orthodox Church that is going kind of off one direction, speaking Greek, developing their theology, developing their culture of church, their church culture. You've got the Latin who's going off in the West doing their own thing. The Eastern Church held a second council of Constantinople in 879 to reverse the decisions and decrees of the first council in 869. So the council was held. The Eastern Church got together and said, we don't like any of those final decisions. So they called their own and reversed the decisions. Between 800 and 1054, the Western Church experienced an inner renewal that gave it strength to deal with its existence in the shadow of the Holy Roman Empire. The Eastern Church became conscious of this and other differences between the East and the West. And here we've got, that is the year is, yeah, is 869. I'm going to jump over to page 293. And this is where it finally comes. That's where it was identified. They're reversing each other's decisions, starting to have their own church councils. By 1054, the East and West Schism is going to be complete. I don't want to read through all of that because I will read through it when we get there. But based in the East, the emperor was almost like a pope. The government was almost like the church leadership. In the West, the pope was almost like an emperor. And then on the next page, 294, you've got, here's just a breakdown of the differences. We'll go back. The difference between the Catholic Church in the West, the Latin Church, and the Greek Church, the Orthodox Church in the East. One is Roman Catholic, the other is Greek Orthodox. One is led by a pope, one is led by a patriarch. Catholic means universal. Orthodox means conforming to the accepted faith. Uses Latin, uses Greek. Original sin, Adam broke God's law by sinning. Adam broke God's image by sinning. Christ came to pay the penalty for sin. Christ came to restore the image of God in man. Focus, the death of Christ. Focus, the resurrection of Christ. Priests live celibate lives. Pastors marry. Government officials are less powerful than the Pope. Government is more powerful than the church leaders. The bread of Mass is unleavened. The bread of the Eucharist is leavened. Clergy may choose to wear a beard, but most do not. Clergy must have a beard. Doctrine of Immaculate Conception of Mary. That means Mary was born of a virgin birth also. She is the mother of God. She has a role in the salvation of man. That's Roman Catholic. Mary is the mother of Jesus, or the Theotokos, the mother of God in flesh, but not the mother of God eternal. In other words, that's kind of what I would believe. She was the mother of Jesus, who was the man, who was the eternal God, but she's not the mother of God. The Catholic Church is going to push it a little bit further. Those are some differences, and that's going to start. They've been coming, but in, like I said, at the bottom of page 290, it's recognized. One church council is canceled out by another church council in Greek, and the Orthodox, and just continues to mount for the next 2-3 centuries, and eventually there's going to be a break. I'm going to pick up on page 291 next week, but right at the top of the page there's a box we'll start with. Reasons for the renewed supremacy of the Western Roman Church over the Eastern Church in Constantinople. So there's two church centers right now. Constantinople, who's under the pressure of the Muslims. Rome, who's also got some pressure from the Muslims, but there's going to be a renewal. Charlemagne is going to have something to do with that as far as education, establishing some systems, and it's going to spread up into Europe, and it's going to renew its strength. Not necessarily a renewal of spiritual truth, vigor, but a renewal of energy as far as reaching its culture and maintaining its life support from that culture. The Eastern Church is going to have another harder row to hoe. They're going to have to fight the Muslims and eventually going to be overrun by the Muslims and kind of almost go into an underground state of survival and going through different periods of time. But we'll talk about that more later. And eventually it's going to lead to a church break in 1094. Another interesting thing very quickly is on page 293. Just look at that map. You can kind of see the different areas. That's by 1094. That's kind of the way the world's broken up at that part right there, the European world. Where Muslim, you can see Muslim there across from Spain going down across North Africa. Greek Orthodox is in Israel and up in Constantinople in that area. You've got Greek Orthodox up into Russia. Celtic Christianity is still way out there in Scotland, and then Roman Catholicism going from Rome, going all the way up to the north into Germany. And that's kind of where the boundaries are of those different Christianities are going to be laid out, matching up there. Okay, I will pray, and we'll pick this up next week. We just kind of flew through some material there. We're covering a lot of things, just kind of giving you a feel for what's going on and some of the highlights that are taking place there in church history. And again, it is our history. I mean, it is our history. That's where we come from. Our faith went through all that and got to where we are today. And it shouldn't be taken lightly. It should be at least considered. That's where the faith has come from. It's gone through these transitions. And it has left some kind of a mark somewhere, somehow, on our system of worship. And think about that and do with it what you want. I'll pray, and I appreciate you coming. Father, I do thank you for the chance to look into church history as your word and your faith has spread across the world. We do ask that we, again, would hold to the truth of your scriptures, hold to the meaning of what Jesus Christ came to do, and to continue to recognize you as the Creator and our Savior and the soon-coming King. We do thank you for church history, and we ask that we, again, would look at it honestly and be able to recognize truth when we see it. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time.